I'm Rick Barden, the co-director of the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project here at CSIS with Karen Von Hippel, and on behalf of John Hamry and other dignitaries from CSIS, it's a great pleasure to welcome you all here. This seems to be Afghanistan week in Washington, so I know many of you are going from one discussion to another, and hopefully there will be the kind of intellectual ferment that this subject deserves at this delicate moment. Afghanistan has had a number of delicate moments over the last few years, and I think if we don't keep thinking of it that way, we're probably going to miss the opportunities that are presenting themselves for us there. We're co-sponsoring this program today with Ambassador Tezzy Schaefer's South Asia program. I think all of you know Tezzy, and she's here to make sure that we stay on track. But also with Princeton University's Liechtenstein Institute on Self-Determination and the Embassy of Liechtenstein. So it's a great pleasure to have Ambassador Claudia Fritschi with us as well. I want to make sure that everybody recognizes Ambassador Jawad and Mrs. Jawad as well. Thank you both for being with us. So it's a great gathering. This is a critical moment in Afghanistan's life cycle, modern life cycle. We had said in our report earlier this year, Breaking Point, that we felt that the summer of 2007 was a chance to really show that we could make changes in the way we were approaching our work in Afghanistan, and that it would be vitally important to make those changes if we were going to be successful and not face an even more difficult 2008. We have grown concerned as we've watched the progress this summer and fall that we have not made the changes that were necessary there. We've had a phenomena that is a disturbing one in Washington, where many, many people come and tell us how the work they are doing is really going quite well. And so we wonder how 100 successes do not add up to one greater success. And the finger-pointing that we have seen is troubling as well, that almost everybody thinks they're doing their job quite well, but they're worried about how others are proceeding with their work. And that obviously is not going to be a winning approach, whether people hold the United States responsible, or they hold NATO, or they hold particular countries of NATO, or whether they hold the Afghan leadership. Everybody seems to have some favorite scapegoat that isn't allowing them to be allowing the greater enterprise to move forward, and it really is the greater enterprise that's important. So on January 16th, as a follow-on to this discussion, we are going to have another program here with George Varghese, the Asia Foundation's country representative, and he's going to present their nationwide survey, which I think many of you have seen, but we'll have a chance for a greater discussion. And then we're going to report on how we feel things have gone since our last report. So we'll have a little report card that I think we'll probably see some passing grades, but we're not quite where we want to be. It's a great pleasure to introduce Ambassador Claudia Fritschi from Liechtenstein, who is going to introduce our moderator, who will then run the program. We are able to do this today because of her encouragement, and we've also had the support of the Carnegie Corporation of New York, which makes much of our work possible. So thank you all very much for coming. I'm looking forward to this discussion. I know that all of you will bring much to it as well. And Ambassador Fritschi, if you would, please.
Good morning. It is a great pleasure indeed for me to be here with you at CSIS, focusing on the topic of Afghanistan's future. My thanks go to Ambassador Schaefer, to Rick Barton, and to Seema Patel. I know this all came about at rather short notice, and my embassy certainly did the encouragement, but you did all the rest, and I highly appreciate that. I would very briefly like to recognize the Honorable Fazia Kofi, Deputy Speaker of the Walesi Jirga. I think this is a transition period. You are still the Speaker, but there is going to be a change. I think I am correct in describing you as a pioneering woman, serving as the first female Deputy Speaker of Afghanistan's lower house of parliament. You are also one of the Parliament's youngest members, and I venture to say that this is the start of a very, very promising career in which I wish you much success. I would furthermore like to welcome my friends, Ambassador Jawad and Mrs. Jawad, and I thank Ambassador Ronald Newman, former U.S. Ambassador to Afghanistan, for being here and for agreeing to share your insight with us. For the very first time, and those of you who don't know, the Liechtenstein Embassy in Washington exists only since 5 years, and that may explain it, I have the opportunity to present to you the Liechtenstein Institute on Self-Determination at the Woodrow Wilson School in Princeton. Professor Wolfgang Danchbeck-Gruber, founding director of the Institute, who will moderate today's discussion, is the driving force behind a small academic institution, the only one in the United States bearing the name Liechtenstein. LISD seeks to enhance peace and stability by contributing to the understanding of the root causes of a people's desire for increased autonomy or independence, while reducing the potentially violent process that can occur in times of transition. This is one of the tasks that the Institute has given itself. You may be wondering why and how Liechtenstein would be involved in these issues, including questions pertaining to Afghanistan. In 1995, upon the initiative of the reigning Prince of Liechtenstein, His Highness Prince Hans Adam II, the Liechtenstein Research Program on Self-Determination was created at Princeton University. Prince Hans Adam has continued to fund this research program, which was transformed to an institute in the year 2000. As Professor Danchbeck-Gruber will explain, the Liechtenstein Institute on Self-Determination's project work on Afghanistan began 2 months after 9/11, launching the interdisciplinary project called Building Security and State in Afghanistan. Through visits to the region and a series of meetings and international conferences in the United States and in Europe, including Liechtenstein, the project has brought together academics, policymakers, government officials and field practitioners to examine international and local best practices for state and security building in Afghanistan. The most recent meeting took place in Brussels 3 weeks ago, and at this meeting, the book entitled Building State and Security in Afghanistan was released, and I'm sure Professor Danchbeck-Gruber will tell us about it. Let me conclude by again thanking CSIS for providing the venue, for co-sponsoring the event, and for all the logistical support. Wolfgang, it's all yours. Thank you.
Stay here, thank you. Thank you for these kind words, and may I just reciprocate that I have had the honor and pleasure to meet a certain young representative, permanent representative of a fresh new member of the United Nations with the name Claudia Fritzsche in 1991, as the first ambassadress of the small principality of Liechtenstein, which according to the old League of Nations regulations would not even have had the right to be a member of an international organization, because it has, of course, much less than 1 million inhabitants. She put Liechtenstein on the map in the United Nations tremendously, and just mention this to somebody like Sergei Lavrov, you will see the effects of it still today, and I realize now that Ambassador Fritzsche has managed to do such a success story once again in the capital of the currently, some would say, sole superpower. It's a great pleasure for me to be with you today, and as a former student of mine who works now with the current United Nations Secretary General says, if there has ever been an element of diplomatic deception in a title, then it is in ours. It's the Liechtenstein Institute on Self-Determination. Yes, we are sponsored by Liechtenstein. Yes, we are at Princeton University. But no, we do not only and wholeheartedly work on issues of state and self-determination, or, as some people say, the dangerous slippery slope of state-shattering movements. On the contrary, I firmly personally believe that self-determination to its fullest extent is actually a rather dangerous endeavor and has to be treated with utmost care. If you don't believe me, look at the Balkans, at South Asia, at Caucasus, at the 5 Ks, which I call think about crisis, which begin with a K. The last K, by the way, is Kaliningrad. We have been engaged in what Joschka Fischer so nicely calls really crisis diplomacy. We try to involve, thanks to the support of His Serene Highness, the Prince of Liechtenstein, and to able diplomats like Claudia Fritzsche, we try to involve all sorts of private diplomacy means in order to achieve successes which do not lead to bloody conflicts. But one of my most important tasks since 22 years at Princeton has been really to do so by educating the next generation of leaders. We have had by now at least more than 80 students who run through our institute. And some of them, some of their names, I'm sure would sound familiar very well, very familiar to you. It is whatever we do in private diplomacy, whatever we do in specialized meetings, in specialized projects, I always do them with my students, who typically are students from the region and who speak the language and who know the inside and who sometimes come from ruling families where they go back to the region and make a change. It is also because of this experience myself that I have been involved in Afghanistan. Believe it or not, I wrote my first paper on Afghanistan in 1981, the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. And I used materials from a certain Salmai Khalilzad, who at that time used various writings. And I was in Geneva, the Graduate Institute of International Studies. And ever since, I followed the country very closely. And I happened to be in Islamabad to work on Kashmir, coming from Srinagar, in a certain week of March 20th, 2001. And it happened to be precisely the week when the two Bamiyan Buddhas were detonated. And I can't tell you, when you were in Islamabad at that time, the vibes you got. That's the first time in my life, and presumably the last time, that I saw a truck full of cash. You may recall, the French embassy tried to purchase the Bamiyan Buddhas with pure cash. It was really unforgettable. And when I came home back to Princeton in May 2001, we had the first meeting on the role of the Taliban and emerging security issues with people like Steve Cohen and others. And from then on, we ventured in. And as Ambassador Fritzsche rightly said, 6 weeks after 9/11, I hosted totally incognito 8 Afghan leaders, amongst them former Vice President Sarabi, in Princeton to talk about federal and confederal structured constitutions. And I used the German, the Swiss, and the Austrian model. And I had a certain Hans-Ulrich Seitz with me at that time, who is now the German ambassador to Kabul. Having said all this, I have rarely met someone who has been involved in our project since now 3 years, who for me so much represents the new and the emerging Afghanistan. Madame Fasia Kofi has been a leading force in Afghanistan, in the parliament, but most importantly, representing the other Afghanistan by being a young woman who would speak fearlessly in many instances her opinion, who also has the ability to, in an amazing English eloquence, convey her and her country's concerns to the international community, and who has again and again in our meetings from Vienna to Brussels contributed with brilliant ideas and insightful analysis, and has fulfilled the other aspect which I expect from my participant when they go home to do the appropriate changes and try to implement them. And we were hence very delighted when she, in perhaps no total fashion of traditional Islamic upbringing, agreed to come to Princeton and to come to the United States and she has been tireless in spending hours and hours with my students, both senior graduate students and others and faculty members, and really in an amazing display of personal civil courage and insight as the representative of Badakhshan to bring her own opinion to, and I have to admit, we had, I think there was no female graduate student from the Woodrow Wilson School who hasn't met her this last 48 hours. So we thought it would be a very appropriate timing to have her come to Washington. And one of the reasons perhaps why there's such an upflow of interest in Afghanistan is that, as you all know, ladies and gentlemen, 6 years ago, roughly to this week, the Taliban fell. And we were all full of hope. And I think we still should be full of hope. And I think we still can convey that, yes, of course, with all its flaws, but compared to where we were 6 years ago, Afghanistan is a success story, even if it's limited. And Afghanistan is more than just a glass half full. But Afghanistan may need new forms of engagement. I refrain from going further now because I should operate as the moderator. And so it is my great pleasure to first introduce Madame Kofi and then offer the floor to somebody who in this halls and by far beyond does not need much introduction, namely Ambassador Ronald Newman, who was considered one of the great displays of American diplomacy in Afghanistan, even if it was too short. So, Madame, if you don't mind, why don't we offer you the floor? Please go ahead.
Ladies and gentlemen, distinguished panelists, member, distinguished ambassadors, it's a honor, a pleasure for me to be here today and to, as somebody who has been living in Afghanistan throughout my life and especially who has been heavily involved on issues and the new process in Afghanistan for the past 6 years since after the bond process, to give you to share my experience with you, not to give a lecture or a speech, because I know that you all have a lot of information about Afghanistan and you all access to many professional analysis about Afghanistan. I don't try to give you a professional analysis about Afghanistan. I try to give you the view of an ordinary Afghan who lives in Afghanistan, especially for the past 6 years. Using this opportunity, I would like to thank Princeton University and Liechtenstein Institute for Self-Determination for giving me this opportunity to raise the voice of Afghan women and Afghan residents, the real voice, because apparently my understanding is that in the United States and in the Europe, there has been little information about the actual situation of Afghanistan. What you see is you see through media the suicide attack and the bomb attack. Little report on progress and achievement in Afghanistan. So they have provided this wonderful opportunity for me to share the actual situation in Afghanistan with students and with scholars and with member of civil society and with people who have been working in Afghanistan in the past and people who would like to work in Afghanistan. So this was a tremendous opportunity for me. And also let me take this opportunity to thank Ambassador Claudia Frishta for giving this opportunity, which is, I think, very important for Afghanistan future and past. As I said last night, it's the quality of service is very important for Afghanistan, no matter what you do, but what you do is quality-wise makes a difference for people of Afghanistan. The fact that you provided this opportunity so that we share the real situation and the challenges that is faced the current government and the process in Afghanistan makes a difference for future planning. So let me thank you very much for giving me this this opportunity and providing this space for us. As I said, I was giving the understanding that I have to address prominent people here, I decided to prepare a speech of, analytic speech, gathering some information from internet, etc. But then I decided, am I presenting the real, realistic situation in Afghanistan, or shall I go for a wonderful speech just to make the audiences busy?
I decided let me be realistic and let me represent the actual situation in Afghanistan. And this is in a situation that we are celebrating the 6th year anniversary, almost a 6th year anniversary of Bonn process, which laid out the roadmap for establishing or state building in Afghanistan, let's put it that way. State building in a way that certain things were agreed, tick mark in Bonn for establishing democratic institutions and democratic state, which is the people's demand, the people of Afghanistan's demand. People in Afghanistan believed in democracy, and they believe in people participation. It's only the political situation in Afghanistan which limited this opportunity for people throughout the history, especially in the past 30 years of conflict. So it's not the people of Afghanistan who don't believe or trust the democratic processes. And Bonn actually paved road for this people's participation. Well, the presidential election, which more than 8 million people participated, and out of which 44% of them were women, voters were women. It was a great achievement for the country's history because, well, you can impose certain ideas, but you cannot impose 44% of women to go and vote. So it's a natural process in Afghanistan, and it indicates that there was the natural process of participation by women. They gave legitimacy to the government by their 44% of vote, and they elected the first democratically elected president, Hamid Karzai. They, one year later, went for election of parliament. We have a parliament with 27% woman representation. You have a parliament where in Afghanistan that people who used to be extremist Mujahideen Islamic fundamentalists, people who used to be strong member of the ex-communist regime, people, poor people, Democrats like me, sit under one roof and they talk about issues. I keep repeating this example, and let me share this with you. 6 years back, when I heard the name of some of these Mujahideen leaders, I was afraid of their names even, because I thought maybe they are against women's rights, they are the cause of all these destructions in Afghanistan. But it happens that now we sit under one roof and we share same color of card. Sometimes it's coincidentally that we share same color of card, votes mean, with these Mujahideen leaders. So isn't it an achievement for people of Afghanistan? People who used to use guns and weapons against each other, people who used to kill people for nothing, they now sit and talk and try to present their justification. I think this is a big achievement for people of Afghanistan and for Afghanistan partners on this process. And the fact that we share common issues on many things, it is a great achievement for people of Afghanistan and for our partners. Presence of 68 women in the lower house and 21 women in the upper house, which consists 27% of women in parliament or members in parliament, is for the first time in the country's history. We had women in political era of Afghanistan during 1960s and 70s and during communist regime, but with that amount of quantity and with the quality that they make a voice and they make a change and that their voice is effective, this is for the first time in country's history. We have a woman vice president in the country's history, which never repeated before, and this is not just symbolic. I was elected as a deputy speaker of the parliament for the first time in a country's history, and this is in a situation that this parliament seems to be made of all extremists and people who have been involved in fighting and war before. So we don't really expect them to vote for a woman, and the fact that they realize the values of democracy is a big achievement for Afghanistan, and it's not a symbolic achievement. We don't try to copy Western democracy or United States democracy. I'm sure in your democracy, you just had a woman as a Speaker of the House recently. That is also for the first time. We were 1 year ahead of you. London Compact was another step for establishing, or London Conference was another step for establishing democratic institutions like police and army and rule of law and bringing security, strengthening security in Afghanistan. As a result, they have agreed to have a national army of 70,000 and a national police of 60,000 people who could be engaged and put in the leadership for bringing security in Afghanistan. We haven't been able to achieve in terms of figures to establish an army of 70,000 people, but we have a quality army in Afghanistan. We have an army that in many occasions leads the operation in fight against terrorists with our alliance, international NATO and ISAF forces. We have a police, and let me tell you, there was a lot of criticism on police, and a lot of, I was one of the critical politicians on police in Afghanistan, but let me tell you that since last year, there is a huge improvement in the quality of national police in Afghanistan. I can give you an example in Kabul. Last year we had an increase in crimes inside the city. This year we have a decrease, and perhaps you have heard through media that there was a German lady kidnapped, and tomorrow she was released with the support of NDS, the National Security Department, and police. She was released from the same area that she was kidnapped. So it's out of expectations of most of the Afghan that the police is and the national security forces are that capable that they could arrest the kidnappers. It's an enormous achievement for the people. Perhaps the cases are very few, but the quality, the fact that the police, who's, you know, seems to be from these former militias, irregular groups, is made of these militia irregular groups, seems to be more responsible toward what they do, is a big achievement for the people of Afghanistan. We had a lot of progress on development, humanitarian issues. I keep saying this, that 6.5 million children managed to go to school after the fall of Taliban, out of which 40% are girls. And I say that if you want to have a golden future for women of Afghanistan, it's important that we educate men of Afghanistan today. Because men are the main decision maker for children to go to school. And I'm glad that even in unsecured areas, we have schools open. Although there is maybe less school building, there is less professional teacher, there is less textbooks, less stationery for them. They have to share in many schools one book among all of them. But the fact that they are interested. I remember that 30 years back, the principal of the schools had to push the families to send their children to school. Now, the families push the government to build more schools for them. It indicates how people of Afghanistan are open to this process and how the democratic process is successful in Afghanistan. We have 85% health coverage to the population, which is great achievement. We still need to improve it. We have women participation as a gender equity aspect in all social and political life, but also we have still violence against women. The parliament seems to become the center point for women voice, especially the 68 women members of the parliament seems to be like the one voice of women in Afghanistan. In many issues, they have a one stand, which is great. In many issues, when it comes to women, they have one stand. And in fact, we had 3 months back a discussion, a debate on establishing a gender unit within the Ministry of Finance to monitor and oversee gender issues and gender budgeting. Some of the main colleagues disagreed with us, saying that, the fact that you are with us is against sitting under one roof is against Islam. So why you are asking for more rights? Some of those MPs that you can, fundamentalists, that they want to interpret Islam the way that they want. So all these women got together and walk out from the parliament session. 68 women, the seats were empty in parliament, and suddenly the speaker was also supportive. He said, okay, we need to listen to these women. And we came back and we managed to win on this process. And they agreed with us to establish a gender unit within the Ministry of Finance. On the inclusion of the one woman at the Supreme Court, we made a lot of efforts with the Because Supreme Court, we would like to make it more woman-friendly, so the justice system of Afghanistan to become more gender-sensitive and woman-friendly to women. We tried to include one woman as a member of Supreme Court. We had so many meetings with President, but apparently it didn't work out. But the fact that the woman got together to meet President, civil society, indicates that gender and woman issue is a priority for women in the parliament. With all these progress that we have, women seem to be... We have a say that battles of death are played by men. Women have responsibility for the battle of life in Afghanistan. With all this progress that we have, to be realistic, I don't try to give you a scenario, a face that you think no challenges in Afghanistan. We are faced with few challenges, and we want to work jointly with our supporters, with our strategic partners, to tackle these challenges. The main challenge that the Afghanistan government is faced, as you perhaps follow the media, is security issue in Afghanistan. Poppy cultivation and corruption or lack of rule of law that are linked or are feeding each other. On security, luckily the parliament just today, presented a resolution to the president that covers many aspects, especially putting Afghan forces on the leadership with the support of international community and ISAF and NATO. The other aspect that this resolution covers is that putting more pressure on neighboring countries that seems to have more impact on the situation in Afghanistan. For us, all these neighboring countries have their own agenda that they want to impose to Afghanistan, and which tries to destabilize the situation in Afghanistan, because for them, a free, stable Afghanistan is not in their interest. So everybody imposes their own agenda. And that is the responsibility of international community and Afghan government to put pressure on neighboring countries. The poppy, I'm surprised people don't talk about all these good things in Afghanistan. We were one of the first countries who had a caracol business. We have the best fruit in the world when it comes to taste. We have lapis lazuli, which is one of the three countries, but always they talk about poppy. And you know, poppy, Afghanistan is not the demand country. Poppy is not used in Afghanistan, and all the money doesn't come to Afghans' pocket. It's a mafia. It goes to neighboring countries, and it needs a regional and rather international effort. So we shouldn't blame. Well, the primary responsibility comes to Afghan government and Afghanistan people, and we, a responsible government, try to be responsive to the criticism that we receive. But on the other hand, it requires a regional and international cooperation. Corruption again leads to is connected to poppy, because some people who are part of mafia doesn't want to have a transparent system, but parliament tries to have an important role, especially in 2006. We voted for a member of Supreme Court, and they seem to be more reformist in working on corruption. The parliament ratified a UN Convention on Anti-Corruption, but I can't remember the exact name, but we, during 2007, ratified the UN Convention on Anti-Corruption, which is a big achievement for the government. We now try to implement all these instruments that we have, and I think taking the oversight rule of parliament, we have played an important role in terms of reviewing individual cases of corrupt cases, and we hope that some positive changes will come, but the government establishing state-building process is a lengthy process. It's not one night or two night process. So we want international community to help us to build a stable, democratic state of Afghanistan. Thank you very much.
I was going to speak sitting down, but I realized I couldn't see this half of the room, so I thought I should stand up. I don't want to really detract too much from the opportunity you have today to have a very personal and close perspective on Afghanistan from Her Excellency Fawzia Coffey. So let me just offer a few reflections and try to stay, although perhaps it's unusual, with the actual topics you posed in the speech when you set it up. You asked, are we facing up to obstacles for recovery and what changes are needed? Basically, are we ready for 2008? And there is no simple answer to that. One of the problems which I think bedevils all of us is that Afghanistan is a country of just an incredible number of details, variables, pieces, and many of them are capable of changing their complexion from time to time, depending on local factors. They don't give a numerical average. You can't sum them up. And we live in a soundbite culture that constantly wants, well, is it good or bad? And, you know, let me give you 500 shades of maybe is a sort of unsatisfactory answer to most people. And yet, in many respects, it's where we are. And we have a constant struggle between realism and expectation, because we can be so realistic that we say this is the way things are and they're unacceptable. And if you don't fix them, you will probably lose because people will get tired of you. On the other hand, if we are unrealistic in our expectations, we constantly make ourselves out failures because we set an expectation that is unrealizable. And then we judge ourselves, or the Afghans, whoever, to be failures. And I think there's a certain amount of that in the CSIS study, that some of it is very necessary. All of it's necessary. Some of it is simply unrealistic in what can be done in the time frame shown. Now, you can say also that something's unrealistic, but unfortunately you lose because you don't get it done. So realism is not the sole judgment factor, but it is an important one to bring to bear. I think more and more that CSIS had, I don't know, six or seven factors that they were judging in their study. I'm tending to think of Afghanistan in perhaps three different ways, because I think one of the things that bedevils our understanding is trying too much to interrelate too many things that impact each other but move on very different levels. And so I've been thinking more and more that we need to think of Afghanistan in sort of three groups of issues. One is obviously security. A second is economic reconstruction, donor cooperation. And the third is the whole development of political culture in Afghanistan, a government that tries to serve people rather than itself, a government that can build real popular support to the level that people will actually take some level measure of risk to support the government. Not that they don't oppose it, but that they feel that it is worth actually working for it. All of these are on very, very different timelines, and they pose different problems. And when we try to bunch them into one thing and then say, what's the conclusion, we drive ourselves crazy. Let me just talk very quickly about three of them. That is, on the security, I believe there is real serious progress with the Afghan National Army. I'm glad to hear Ms. Kufi say she feels we were talking about the police situation in Kabul, which was particularly troubled for a long time. I was very glad to hear her say, and I've heard some recent other visitors say, that they feel it is improving, and that is very important because the crime level, not the bombs, but it was the crime level, which was increasingly impacting economic performance and the willingness of businessmen to come to Kabul. This was an element which was not reflected at all in the foreign press, which pays attention only to the suicide bomber. In fact, it was much more important to the development of Kabul and the mood of the people and business confidence. It's actually getting better. I think part of getting better may be that they finally got, I think, a really professional police chief who is interested in shaping up his force. That posed an interesting problem for us because we'd done very little to support the Kabul police force for several years because we thought it was too rotten an institution to be worth investing in. So all of a sudden, when you had a good chief of police who's worth supporting, one of the first things I did was go over and pay a visit to police headquarters on a snowy day, which apparently lit up a lot of telephone lines. But all of a sudden, we find we're not really positioned right. We don't have the mechanisms in place. We've got to switch programs and funds in order to suddenly support something that's now worth supporting. This kind of problem goes on and on, but we're a long way from where we need to be in the police as a whole. We focus this too much, though, on a policy level and too little on implementation. Building an army is a complex process, and it takes time. And it is very important not to rush it too much. And we have continually harmed ourselves by trying to push forces into being too fast, to push them into combat too quickly, and to keep them in combat too long when they're not ready. And then what we do is we grind up what we're building, and then we turn around and we say, gosh darn it, there just isn't enough army and it isn't good enough. And we're now, I think, on a much better program. But we have to avoid this, and we have to avoid or contain the impatience that wants us to either overuse something when it's too small or to criticize for being, it's not good enough, and then it pushes you to do something which is stupid and wasteful and breaks the force. I think we're moving on a much better line with the Afghan army now. The most important thing to me is the Afghan army is incredibly respected. I traveled constantly. I never went to a province where I did not hear from the governor, from community leaders, we want more Afghan army. Why can't we have more force now? But the reason is you don't have any, but it's a constant refrain. This is very, very different from a lot of Iraq. It's one of those things that gets very little attention. It is hugely promising, but to realize the promise, we have to be measured in the building. And it's strange because we've figured this out in our own forces. You know, we're saying, my God, 15 months is too long a deployment. We're going to break the force if we keep this up. We're keeping Afghan battalions on the line in combat for 2 and 3 years is what we were doing. Yeah, and then we turn around and we're surprised and we say, gosh, they're 35% strength. Amazing. Actually, some of them performed very well at that strength. The largest, kind of brutal statistic, but the greatest killing of the battle, Operation Medusa outside Kandahar, was done by one Afghan battalion with Special Forces advisors. And they took care of a lot more Taliban than any of the other forces involved in that battle. They were also at 35% strength. We've got to get them off the line. Security is hard to evaluate. Let me give you one more example and get off security. Helmand Province, probably the most violent, there's a lot of contenders for that. We're dealing with what's going on in Arghandab and north of Kandahar and all kinds of things. But it's very violent. And it is easy to look at Helmand. British press is especially good at this. They follow British soldiers around. They say there's a big battle and, oh my God, everything's gone to hell. It's very easy to limit your analysis of Helmand to that. I would say two things. One, I don't believe we had any control of Helmand in 2005 and 2006 when we turned it over to NATO. We had less than 200 people in an American PRT, and yes, you could drive pretty much anywhere in the province. But that was mostly because we weren't bothering the people who actually controlled the province, and it wasn't particularly in their interest to bother us. That wasn't government. That wasn't state building. It wasn't control, and it wasn't getting anywhere towards state control. It was the bazaar down by the border was well known to be totally open, controlled by drug dealers. Shortly before we took the PRT out, you had a convoy of 200 policemen that was engaged and took major casualties. This was not a province that was under control. It was just not being bothered very much. When NATO came in, it erupted for a lot of reasons, but part of that was that the NATO force was challenging everybody else who was there who was controlling it. And partly it was very badly governed, a lot of reasons. When we started this year, and I think it's important to remember this, This was to be the year of the major Taliban offensive. Big lecture by press piece by Mullah Dadullah about how they were going to roll over Helmand and they were going to take Lashkar. And I think the general Americans were saying, why isn't there an offensive in February, March, and April? Afghans were saying, my God, all of Helmand is controlled by Taliban except for Lashkar. At the end of the year, in the winter as we are now, where are we? Well, we probably have marginally better control of 3 or 4 districts out of 15. We're in a few others that we weren't in before. We're still in a struggle, a place called Sangin. We've killed Mullah Dadullah. He isn't making speeches anymore. And we've killed quite a few of his commanders. It's up for grabs, but it is not the offensive the Taliban predicted. I don't say we've won the battle there. We clearly have not. We don't have enough NATO troops. NATO hasn't stepped up to it. We're short of American instructors. We're short of foreign instructors. We have many really, really important issues we've got to focus on in the security. We're pretty good in the dollar terms. We're not adequate in the people. We don't have enough Americans. We don't have enough NATO forces. And the NATO forces don't stay long enough. The numbers are more important than the caveats. We talk constantly about the caveats, who can go into war and who can't. And we don't talk about the numbers. There's 3,000 Germans in the north. Only 700 of them are infantry. If they had no caveats and you could use them any place in the country, you couldn't take them out of the north because you need them there. In fact, you need about 4 times that number. The European approach is at least as defective as ours. Let me put it in that way. If we are too violent, they are not sufficiently present. In Kosovo, we have about a ratio of about 1 police mentor to 10 policemen. In Afghanistan, we have something closer to 1 to 100. So we have to pull our socks up. They have a huge problem of corruption, of efficiency, and it's going to take them a long time to fix that because it is the transformation of the society, and societies do not transform quickly, except maybe America that talks about, you know, the generation of the 60s, 70s, 80s and expects to have a new culture every 10 years. But that's not normal in the world. I think one of the things we will have to do, and it is going to be the hardest for the foreigners, is to say how much can we realistically expect and push for that rather than set unrealistic expectations and then always account them failure. Let me just then for 2 minutes talk about the developmental side from a particular perspective because it's going to get a lot more focus this year. There are stories about whether or not Patty Ashdown will become a special coordinator and all of this stuff. We have not met Afghan expectations, and those probably could not be met. We have not managed either Afghan or Western expectations well. We talk in too broad and sweeping terms about what needs to be done and the solutions, and therefore leave people to expect that if you adopt a solution, you now are going to see something. We don't talk about delays and timelines. Let me give you 2 examples. 1, money. Washington is a policy town. It focuses on policy decisions. It pays no attention to the lag between a decision and implementation. So inside the executive branch, you have a great sense of victory when you make a decision, which we made in about December of last year, that we would have a big, huge supplemental this year. In the larger Washington community, of great satisfaction when you announce in February that there's about $2 billion over the next couple of years for economics, leaving aside the military piece. Sometime in the summer, the Congress gets around to voting a fair piece of that, and some of it won't be voted till the fall. And then sometime in the fall, and this year about September, it starts getting out. By the time it's allocated and moves in the bureaucracy, it gets to the field. By that time, of course, let's say you're going to do a road. We want to do a lot of I wanted to do a lot of roads. I did some of them. It's now you've got to do engineering studies. Maybe you've gotten a little bit of a head start on that. Maybe you've got an umbrella contract, but you've got to you got to now put out the bids for the subcontract. You got to demine the place so you don't blow up your contractors. And by the way, it's winter and you can't build anyway. So the decision you made in 2006 to have a supplemental will start building a road in 2008. And it's not because anybody has screwed it up or done something wrong. It's because it takes that long. It's also the price of having a democracy and having a legislature that governs our funds, and that's part of our Constitution and part of the way free people stay free. But there's a price for it. There's a huge time lag. What you do between 2006 and 2008 is implementation. It's what you do with the money you already have. If you don't keep the pipeline rolling, if you don't keep appropriations adequate, then you lose flexibility. So in 2006, we did what's called a reprogramming. We scraped around to figure out how pieces we could move. And we did some useful things. I think one thing that I'm pretty sure Ms. Kofi would agree is useful is we decided we would build a road from Kishim to Faizabad and Badakhshan. We're not quite where I'd like to see us. That road, I think, will get started in the spring. It is going ahead, I've checked. But I would have liked to see us turn dirt last year. But because we had to reprogram for that road, for a road from Gardez to Host for the dam at Kajikai, we really squeezed out most of our flexibility. So later in 2006, as the fighting got worse and we wanted to build more roads in the provincial capitals in the south, we couldn't do it because there was no money to do it. We got a little, but we didn't get what we wanted. One piece of implementation then is to maintain a certain flexibility and a level of funding, because without that, you lose your ability to respond. The ability to respond has to be at the country. It is not the policy. There is this second and last thing I want to talk about in implementation, which is that a great deal of the potential improvement in implementation, and Lord knows there's room for improvement, is in implementation in Kabul and within the country. It is not in the policy. And that is effectively not understood in Washington, not only by this administration, but by almost anybody. It is not what academics look at, and it is not understood in capitals. And the idea that we're going to get a huge amount of increased coordination because we import a coordinator of some type is, to my mind, utter nonsense. And it is nonsense for a very simple reason, because you're talking about sovereign states, and they are not going to say, yes, sir. So the level of coordination you will get is on a level that we call motherhood and apple pie. It is a level of general policy which is largely meaningless to what you actually do. You can get a lot better coordination. You can get it at the local level. We got it in some respects. Energy, where we brought together, under UNAMA sponsorship, Germany, India, ourselves, World Bank, Asian Development Bank, the main players building the energy transmission line, power line. We produced out of that a consensus on what policy ought to be, a consensus we took to the Afghan government, which they have now implemented in terms of their own coordination mechanisms. And over time, it was not easy, but over time we have a better coordination in the process among the donors. This is an informal process run in Kabul. It gets no attention by scholars, and it gets no attention by governments, but it produces results. It has produced a level of agreement on which were the major laws that ought to, the donor agreement on which were the major laws that ought to get passed this year in economic and commercial terms in order to facilitate business. It was a consensus reached in that case with the government of Afghanistan, with the key ministries. It was vital, because otherwise every foreign advisor is pushing his or her pet project in each ministry, and you have complete chaos. That is not a confusion which can be overcome at the level of capitals. But what you need to have to do it better are certain specific tools and agreements. You need to give your ambassadors in the country the requisite authority. That's not a problem for us, for the Americans. The ambassador has as much authority as he can grab and use. It is a great problem for the Europeans because the development ministries are separate from the foreign ministry. And therefore, you have a huge amount of resistance in the technicians to bring an issue when it is stuck to political levels for resolution. That is not going to be fixed by having a super coordinator. It's going to be fixed by dealing with your authority structures within your individual countries. You have a potential for troubleshooting and identifying problems and cracking those problems at the local level, but to do it, you have to have enough senior officials who think policy as well as enough technicians. We don't. AID does not. UNAMA does not. But it is identifiable. It is reinforceable. All that said, we have made a lot of progress. The problem is that you measure progress in hard facts when you discuss it, but the ultimate measure is a purely subjective political perception, and ultimately it is the political perception of Afghans and not foreigners that is the only one that matters, because it is their support that, well, it's not the only one that matters, because if the foreigners lose the perception of progress, they won't pay for it, in which case then failure is assured. But it is ultimately perception much more than the facts we deal with that will condition the future facts. It is a somewhat a bizarre state of life, and one, you know, which is deeply offensive to the academic and policy cognoscenti who want things to be based on hard analysis, but it's kind of the way life runs. And so what I would say to you is we have not made as much progress as anybody wants. We have made, by any standard of a post-conflict country, I say we, the international community, we, the Afghans, have, I think, made as much or more progress as any comparable case of a post-conflict society in the time we've had. And that is, however, does not answer the question, because the question is not more or less, it is sufficient or insufficient. It is right on the margin. We are not resourcing, we the Americans, and we, the international community, are not resourcing ourselves for a margin of victory. We are resourcing ourselves not to lose. We are not resourcing to win. And that, I would say, is the major problem that we will need to deal with in Washington in 2008. And to close, just so I don't leave that statement hanging with no supporting evidence whatsoever, we have done a good job in resourcing equipment for the police and army. If we, the international community, cannot resource adequately the trainers to have a sufficient ratio of teams per battalion, Kandak in Afghan terms, or mentors for police, we cannot possibly achieve the results destined for that equipment in the time we've set out to achieve it. So we got to do both. We have too few foreign troops in Afghanistan. NATO does not have the level of battalions its own military committee has designated as required, and that designation is 3 years out of date and is clearly insufficient. We are at least four battalions. I mean, when you look at it, we have a total of about 40,000 NATO troops in Afghanistan. And not all of those are combat, including about half are involved in training and all kinds of things that are not part of the combat mission. It's Iraq, you're talking, we now have 160,000 soldiers in Iraq. Iraq is slightly smaller than Afghanistan. Right, note that again. 160,000 against 40. Iraq is slightly smaller. Its population is slightly smaller. And it is geographically much more permissive than Afghanistan. It may be hot, but you don't have to go up and down there as much. We have no troops effectively stationed on the border of Helmand, Kandahar, Nimruz, Zabul. 50% of the Pakistani-Afghan border has no forces, except patrols. I say to you, we do not have enough troops, we are not putting enough advisors in, and we don't stay long enough. For all that, we're doing pretty well. You know, the Army's making good progress, it fights, Afghans like it. But we are, that's why I say we are resourcing not to lose, we're not resourcing to win. That is my message of the day, and I think I talked too long. Thank you.
Let me quickly take the prerogative of the chair and be advocatus diaboli before I offer the floor and give you three messages, which actually there's a fourth one, which I...
We could still... Sorry. I just thought if we moved it a little, then we could...
Oh, that you could... Oh, that's right.
Cut off from that. That's good. That's good.
Which counts very much as the ambassador just ended, namely, it is really perception which forms reality. The problem is it's not just the perception which forms reality in Afghanistan, but also the perception which forms reality in donor countries, in the outside world. I throw three points here into the discussion, and we can then elaborate it later on. First of all, dear friends, ladies and gentlemen, time is running out. We have said it many times, but I have heard in the last 12 months terms which I've never heard before, from occupier to the dirt bubble of Kabul politics to total disenchantment of the population to absolute horrendous effects of collateral damages by bomb attacks. Second point, and this is my full conviction, and I say this as an officer, as a Bronze Star of the Austrian Army, we will not be able to win Afghanistan militarily. Please recognize this. We will certainly not. You have a very famous American military who has been part of our project since 3 years, so he's going to visit Princeton next week. You find all the details about him on our website, who has coined the phrase, the Taliban begins where the road ends. Afghanistan has, if anything, become an economic, socioeconomic infrastructure, an alternative livelihood problem, besides all the problems which both speakers mentioned, but it is not going to be resolved militarily. No way on earth. Should I tell you that Germany, just that close, made a decision a couple of weeks ago to spend yet another year militarily, that I taught 1.5 years with Joschka Fischer, who has himself put it on his shoulders to bring German military to the Hindu Kush, and who knows farewell that the Greens and the SPD are looking for many ways to get out of that again. Third point, and this especially as my message to Washington, the region counts. Issues like the Indo-American nuclear deal have, yes, indeed, major geostrategic ramifications for Pakistan westwards. Ever heard something about strategic depth, strategic hinterland? Ever asked a Pakistani general how he feels about strategic encirclement? Ever asked whether all the discussion of military strikes against Iran may have ramifications on military and security and option level from Herat eastwards? The region counts. And should I remind us here that Afghanistan, also many times in its history, has fallen prey to external events which have nothing to do with Afghanistan, like the liberation of Kuwait and the non-exploitation of the withdrawal by the Soviet Union, or that the shift of financial resources due to the tsunami have suddenly voided the coffers which were originally oriented towards Afghanistan in 2004, because tsunami also happened in an Asian country, and we had limited resources anyhow, so we moved it from one Asian point to the other Asian point, and of course, we overfunded tsunami by I don't know which percentage. Should I remind us that issues like SCO, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, do indeed have both positive
and questionable ramifications for Afghanistan. That China's interest in Pakistani port facilities are as important as India's interest in natural gas, and that the new, what we call, inverse Silk Road phenomenon of energy transit from Iran to China and India have big ramifications for Afghanistan in the larger sense of the thinking. And in all that, we run against the clock. And the clock is public opinion in this country and in its EU allies. And the clock is the public opinion amongst the Afghans, who begin feeling that certain things, than their missed promises, than their missed opportunities, sound more like renewed occupation than actual assistance. Okay, the floor is yours. Yes, please.
I spent some time
Let's collect three questions, please.
You want to make it really impossible before we start.
Yeah.
I'd like to focus on an aspect of Tezi Schaefer from CSIS. I'd like to focus on an aspect of Afghanistan's internal development that got a brief mention in Ambassador Newman's talk, and that is the difference from one region to another. Ambassador Newman mentioned that Helmand was one of the most violent provinces in the country. Ms. Kufi gave two very moving examples of things that were going better in Kabul. My question is, what does it take to establish a meaningful government presence? Security, economics, all of the ways in which government can begin to be a real factor. In areas that are beyond Kabul, and I'm particularly concerned about the parts of the country where this has been harder to do. I mean, not so much the northwest where things seem to be going a bit better, but the parts that have been tough to deal with.
So,
I'm Francis Skorbaszewski, Monolith Capital, but I was at the Enterprise Funds in Poland and Hungary for 15 years. And I just spoke on a panel on Afghan business development a couple weeks ago. I'm curious about what kind of programs and what value there is in working directly with the private sector. So the private sector is mobilized because commerce goes on regardless of what the governments do. People have to eat. People have to buy things. People have to sell. And that helps to bring stability in and of itself if they can be mobilized.
You want to answer?
I defer to the lady in the parliamentarian. Well, I think you ought to talk about what does it take to establish authority. And maybe you could talk about that, especially in terms of Badakhshan, where you have very few resources. How do you move from, I don't mind talking about it in general, but I think you could talk about it especially in terms of what does it take to build a government in Badakhshan that is really a loyal and part of the nation.
Mm-hmm. Well, I will take the part from the gentleman who spent some time in Kosovo and shared the experience on the national collaborator. I think coordination has been an issue in Afghanistan, both coordination among international community but also at the government level. Coordination doesn't mean that you have a meeting and you sit around the table and then you discuss, but at the end of the day you don't agree and you don't share common objective. Coordination means that everybody follows certain principle and common objective for the better and interest of the nation. That is an issue in Afghanistan. And at the government level, it's the responsibility of the government and the responsibility of its institution to coordinate among themselves and also to find a mechanism for coordination within the national community. This seems to also be an issue at the international community level. Different countries have their own bureaucratic way of approaching issues. So I think having a national collaborator would facilitate bringing more coordination among international actors in Afghanistan in order to have one way of approaching one person. People, ministries don't have to coordinate with different ambassadors, with different UN organizations. They could approach them through one way. That is my understanding. But the fear is that we hope it doesn't increase more bureaucracy and bureaucratic approach. But I think there is a need for having a national collaborator or somebody who should coordinate at the international level. The difference between the region and the I would say there should be a balanced approach and a balanced distribution of resources at the country level. We have insecurity in south. You have problem of poppy cultivation in Helmand province, which this year the province has produced 70% of the poppy of Afghanistan. But on the other hand, you have security in the rest of the country, or at least the government ruling and try to strengthen the rule of law and its presence. We also need to consider them, that part of the country where is secure and safe in terms of humanitarian assistance and in terms of equal distribution of resources, which the Afghan constitution also guarantees and ensures. It happens to me when I travel to north or northeast, sometimes I'm asked this question that, you know, in south, people have, there is insecurity, fighting, this operation, different operation, and Taliban and Al-Qaeda, but more attention, political and financial attention is paid. Perhaps this is because of the nature of the region that should be receive more attention. But while in the rest of the country, we are receiving internationals with flowers and with, and I'm sure Ambassador Newman remember our trip to Balakhshan.
Yes.
When I mentioned this, with flower and we welcome them, but less attention. It's not the fact that you have more attention to south, but that is the public perspective. So perhaps you go to south and you receive the same complaint from the people in south. So the right approach would be that we need to a little bit decentralize from Kabul and reach the unreached areas, be it in south or in north. And I take the point from one of the students who used at the Princeton University, Woodrow Wilson School, who used to work in Afghanistan, and she was she had this experience from all the villages. She was pointing the issue of giving more responsibility and power to district manager and governors in terms of manage budget control, because they are with people, and that is the process of state building, that you everybody feels part of the process. And the government in Badakhshan, your ambassador was asking, it's the people actually who are interested in keeping rule of law, in keeping the security. The amount of police you have in that province is, I think, 150 people. But you have less crimes, you have less, no national army in that province at all. You have no national army, believe me, because we need to have national army in areas where there is a need for keeping security. But people are involved in security, in keeping security, in rule of law. What they want from us is the basic needs to be addressed, and that is the responsibility of the government and international community to keep their confidence over the government.
Let me try a few comments. I suspect that the coordinator will be an irrelevance in the provinces, because the issues that people will be dealing with simply will be too discreet and detailed. However it works, good or whether I'm right or wrong about how it will work in Kabul. I think there's going to be a huge disappointment, because I think a lot of people are going to want to do exactly what Ms. Goofy said. Now, good, we can coordinate with the coordinator. We don't have to talk to all the individuals. Except you're wrong. The coordinator will have zero authority to decide. It can only go and appeal and try to coordinate. The decision and the funding will all remain exactly where it was with the bilateral countries and with the ministries that have control of the funding. So I think that one, maybe it'll help, but I think it will not be the end of the story. What does it take to establish authority? It's a mix. The best answer I can give is going to be inadequate. It takes at this point a strong person or two with a certain devotion to the state. Afghanistan has very few, perhaps almost no institutions at this point. It has institutions that are being formed, but they're still very young. They're building. And so it is, on the one hand, one has to continually think about whether policies reinforce institutions or undercut institutions, and at the same time, one has to realize that the importance of the individual is huge. A good governor can make a tremendous difference in a province, and a bad governor will rot everything because there's very little structure. So it takes, first of all, finding the good people. That is really hard. And then you want people that are good, honest, and don't have any blood in the country that's been fighting for 25 years, but you want enough local experience that they're respected. You know, after you've found the four or five of those, you got to deal with everybody else. The second piece you need is an adequate level of force that the governor, senior officials can carry out decisions which they make without being confronted by local groups that in fact outnumber them. And this plays out, what that is different from place to place. In one respect, it is an easier issue in the East because we've had so many U.S. forces there, plus more Afghan security forces, that nobody would dream of confronting a governor militarily for criminal purposes in the East because we'd squash them. The poor governor in Badakhshan has almost nobody who is really undisputably loyal to the national government. The police are effectively the police of certain local commanders who came to roost as police forces. The national government is now changing out. It's a very good program, but it's slow and hard to implement. They've changed out virtually every provincial police chief so that they are no longer from the provinces in which they are the chief. And it needs to get much deeper. It's got to change down to district level, and it's working on that. Because until you have a structure that is both willing to obey and has a purpose that is of obeying something other than a local interest, you won't build a state. How many people you need to do that, though, is going to be very different. You know, a couple of hundred decently trained police with a national authority are probably quite enough to do at least the core functions in a Badakhshan. A couple of thousand of them might be inadequate in Kandahar right now. So it's going to be wildly, wildly different. One other thing I would say about provincial councils, I think ultimately, this is me, it's not a policy, it's not Afghan policy right now, I think they have to be given authority to raise some kind of revenue locally, to tax. Until, I do not think it is a question of giving them revenue from Kabul, first of all, because the central government has no revenue to give them. The development budget is totally in the hands of foreigners, and it will be inconsistent from year to year, and however much it might be, we can't maintain block grants in America for funding states when we give them responsibilities. If we can't do it here, I don't think they're going to do it there. Secondly, if you don't give authority to raise money, then their provincial council, provincial authorities are simply one voice among any number of voices asking for stuff, asking for projects. But they have no responsibility to really choose among them for priority because you're dependent on somebody else. You know, what difference does it make if your priority is A, if the only thing the foreigner will fund is Z? You'll take Z because it beats nothing. And that's human and reasonable. If you gave them authority to raise revenue, then you could, around that, make a certain amount of transparency for the spending.
Thank you. I got just news that I have only one more round left. That's what I give you.
Thank you very much. Just very quickly, as ambassador, I want to thank all friends here for the Liechtenstein Institute, Claudia, and everyone else in CSIS for providing this forum. And then, as an Afghan this time, I'm really very proud to see a representative of the Afghan people speaking here. Truly, it makes us proud. And a lot of the people around in this room are experts of Afghanistan. They've been to Afghanistan. They know Afghanistan from the days that Afghanistan was a source of threat to itself, to the region, to the world. Now we have our Madam Deputy Speaker of the House speaking about rule of law, governance, and other issues in here. This is a big, a major accomplishment for Afghanistan, truly. And we are very proud of the excellent work that you are doing. Just recently, I accompanied another delegation of a member of our parliament headed by Speaker Karuni. And as you know, Speaker Karuni has a different position with the government. He's in opposition. But when it came to the national issues, when debating issues related to the building the state in Afghanistan, he had the same position that every other Afghan had. So this is the big difference that Afghanistan has with many other countries, that on national important issues, Afghans are extremely united. Two very quick comments on the issue of coordination and the international coordinator. The issue of coordination will not be resolved in Afghanistan unless the international community is ready to be coordinated. We have had the concept of lead nation. The lead nation in planning should be Afghanistan. And also, very quickly, on the regional factor, Wolfgang, that you have mentioned, yes, we have been living with difficult neighbors for the past 2,000 years. These are a lot of challenges. Uncertainty in Pakistan, hostility in Iran. But all of these challenges will also provide an opportunity for Afghanistan to position itself once again as a strategic partner and ally for countries that share the same kind of vision. Thank you. And I just wanted to ask a question about what are the pressing social development issues in Badakhshan, one of the biggest and most beautiful provinces in Afghanistan, but I think we are running out of time. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, please.
My name is Hashim Raiq. I'm a member of the Afghan Advocacy Group. Fawzia Kofi, the respected parliament member mentioned, we have seen a lot of difference between the media and what's going on in reality. I mean, if you see the reality in Afghanistan, even if you consider the 2007, really it was a bloody year for Afghanistan people. But beside that one, there was a lot of achievement. There was a lot of development. I, as an engineer, I went over there 4 times after the Taliban collapse, and any time when I go, I see a lot of achievement, a lot of development, nice building, nice road inside the Kabul. But the media doesn't mention anything about this. The media always talking about the issue of the suicide bomb, rocket bomb, and those kind of thing. And every day I am hear the name of the Helmand province. I was engineer for 12 years in Helmand projects, and I love this part of the world. But I never hear about the area which is, safe. I never hear about Badakhshan. I never hear about Mazar-i-Sharif. These are the things that the media, I don't know what is the policy of government of Afghanistan, even the media of Afghanistan, always they are talking about this bad issue. The policy of Afghanistan should be think about this one. So why our group, as now we are establishing here by the name of the Afghan Advocacy Group, try to reduce this gap between the reality and what's going on in the media. And one of our members, Mr. Habibzai, is here with me. And I have another question, which is actually we know that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda is not only the enemy of people of Afghanistan. They are enemy of all the world and democratic around the world. And we know that the main source of Taliban is outside of the border of Afghanistan. And we are fighting and dealing with the branch of these three. If you consider the Al-Qaeda as a big tree with a lot of deep root and branches, the branches is toward Afghanistan, the roof and the body is outside of Afghanistan. Isn't it better to deal with the root of these Taliban instead of fighting with the branches? Thank you very much.
Last question.
Thank you. Thank you. My name is Khaled Majidyar. I'm a fellow at the Jordan University, originally from Kabul. Thank you very much, first, Ms. Kofi, for presenting a very positive portrayal of situation in Afghanistan, which we rarely see or read through the media here. And you've talked about many achievements we've made over the past 6 years, like the democratic constitution. Our president is elected through the general elections, which is the first time in history of Afghanistan. And I totally agree with that. And also, former Ambassador Newman mentioned about that we should our expectation should not be unrealistic, and it's unrealistic to have expected a secure, stable, and prosperous Afghanistan by now. But ultimately, our goal is that. And my question is that, are we on the right track to achieve that goal? And what's the timeline for that? And the realities of the 2007 speaks against that. We saw that it was the deadliest year for the coalition forces, for the Afghan people and the Afghan government as well. And also in terms of the economic growth, it is a projected 8 to 14% of economic growth, but still it's poppy cultivation, illegal drugs business, which constitutes 53% of the GDP. So that means that something is wrong with the policy direction we are following, as well as the international community. And what's wrong, if there is something wrong with that, and how we can correct it? Thank you. And also, if time allows, I have a question from Ambassador Newman about the current policy being considered by the U.S. government that they want to arm the tribesmen in Pakistan. Is that a good idea? And also, what could be just the reason for the Afghan situation? And can we replicate that in Afghanistan? Can we arm the tribesmen to fight the Taliban in Afghanistan? Thank you.
Very much interesting questions and comments. Thank you very much, Ambassador, for the nice words. I will take the last question, which are we on the right track? I think in terms of the process, when you talk of the democratic process in Afghanistan, it is a successful process when you compare it to many post-conflict situations. In this case, for instance, the Iraq issue or other issue countries. It is a process because it is successful. Why it is successful? Because the people of Afghanistan acceptance toward this process is still 75%. And the other 30% people who seems to disagree doesn't mean that they are in favor of Taliban or Al-Qaeda. Means perhaps they are not agree or they don't like one administrator, one minister, whatever. That is the personal disagreement perhaps. But rather the total population, still 75% support this process in Afghanistan. Perhaps we need to have more, look at back and our team, the team that is implementing this process in Afghanistan. We need to see maybe the team needs some revision and something needs to be fixed with the team that is working in Kabul in order to have an Afghan owner process in Afghanistan supported by international community. The international community led by United States and the leading nations in Afghanistan cannot afford lose in Afghanistan, and so do the people of Afghanistan. If we lose this golden opportunity in the country's history, as you know, this government has received the current administration and the people of Afghanistan, the amount of support they receive, both political support, economical support, and military support, is rare in the country's history. So it means this is the golden opportunity in the history of Afghanistan, and we should use it. We should make the maximum use of it. And if we fail in Afghanistan, we, the people of Afghanistan, will be victim again. And we cannot afford to lose that. And not to lose that require a committed team in Afghanistan to achieve the objective. On the media, I think as a democratic state, we try to have not a lot of control over the media. Otherwise, then we receive a lot of complaint from, I don't know, Europe, U.S., that there is no freedom of speech, freedom of media is not ensured there. So in the law that is, the media law which is passed in the Afghanistan parliament, especially the lower house, we try to put more democratic kind of responsibility on media so that the media is has some kind of democratic responsibility to somebody. Which was very much a democratic media law, but when it went to upper house, they tried to impose more restrictions and rule regulations. But I'm glad that the media is that much free, that they could report the way that they want. And I think that is the more, let's put it, sexy way of reporting that people want, and that is something that people want to see. If they talk about inauguration of a bridge building in one province, people might not be interested. But if they talk about a suicide attack, people will watch that. That is.
Yeah, we have a saying in American news: if it bleeds, it leads. And I don't think you're going to get unstuck from that. I know we're practically out of time, so let me just deal only. Well, I didn't want to completely overlook the question about the private sector that we had before, which we didn't answer. I think the private sector is a major component of potential success. Right now, it is still mostly Afghan. There is a small public, small foreign private sector, but it is growing. It is enormously important. It's an integrative process because, for instance, there's this big copper bid now, which the Chinese, I believe, have won. So far, the government of Afghanistan has done very well in managing that bid by international standards. Now they have a series of things they still have to do. How they handle that kind of thing will be enormously important, but there's big investment in agriculture going on in the north. There's a lot of stuff just beginning. These are sort of like little shoots at a field, and if you tend them, you can have quite a field, but they got to be tended. And obviously, basic law. And then on this question of arming tribesmen, this came up after I left the government, so I have no responsibility or authority about it, but I know a little bit about it. I think it is, there are two things coming together here. There's an American fascination with al-Anbar in Iraq, and can't we do something like that, which is really dumber than hell. Then there is an Afghan pressure, which has always been there, not so much from the government, but from many Afghans. We had stability for years by arming the tribes, and depending on the tribes, do more with the tribes. And I recognize I have Afghan friends who believe very strongly that we should do more there. I don't agree with them. One, the tribes themselves are not the tribes of 30 or 40 or 50 years ago. When those tribal leaders came together, a few people represented 10 or 15,000 armed men. Tribes of Afghanistan are now incredibly fractured. To me, the strongest single example of that is the parliamentary elections, where in only one province could one tribe mount a unified tribal slate. That was Badakhshan and Herat. In not a single other province could a single tribe control its people enough to have a tribal slate. Secondly, the tribal leaders are themselves, in many cases, disenfranchised by the rise of commanders. And while the commanders have a tribal base, they are not the same as tribal leaders. We have the entire experience of the post-92 Mujahideen to prove that they can fight, but they are not a stable and controllable force, and you're not building a state. If you get a temporary quiet by building disintegrative forces, you would make an incredibly bad mistake. There are ways to use individuals and to use some leaders, but to arm tribes as tribes, and you won't actually arm tribes, you'll arm commanders. It is to empower the people that we have, and Afghans, have spent the last 6 years resenting. It will undo the Diag process, the disarmament. It will reinforce the power of people who do not respect law and whose behavior is constantly protested by sort of the common Afghan. In short, I can't think, I have to really work to think of a dumber idea to do quickly.
Thank you very much. Let me quickly tell you that question at the end, I found, besides the media question, is a really symbolic issue. Why? Because, as it was said so many times, it changed the perception. But there is a real dangerous element coming in here. Misperception or perception of negative security hamper economic development. So you are beginning to see in those areas where security is a major issue,
lacking in all sort of economic developments. And some people argue you see splits in Afghanistan, where you have a well-to-do, safer area, which then obviously can easier move forward, and those other areas, embattled areas, in a very negative stage. Same thing with the media, sir, and it's especially the international media, where I think one should do some education as well. Speaking about education, you have over there a two-day-old last report from our Brussels conference. And I feel awkward, but many of the questions of economic development, of mining, of infrastructure, of tribes, are answered in our book, which we just finalized two weeks ago, and we sold already more than 1,000 copies, so we are out of it. We have to reprint it, and the Afghan embassy and the Liechtenstein embassy in particular will have copies, but you see, you can order it via Amazon or our website. So join our website, and I wanted to thank very much you as the audience, but particularly the two speakers, Madame Kofi and Ambassador Neumann. And in old Viennese tradition, I wanted to offer you the last word.
Well, I think it was a wonderful opportunity, as Ambassador Jawad said, that people of Afghanistan can agree to some extent, and this agreement is held in this process, this agreement, because by this agreement you finally come to a conclusion. So we agree and disagree, but at the end of the day, for the national interest and for the people of Afghanistan interest, we try to agree, and that is something which is coming up in Afghanistan. The fact that the parliament had separated 2 weeks to discuss on a security resolution, and yesterday they submitted that to the president, and they had a meeting with the president. I contacted them. They had a meeting with the president to sit and agree on this security resolution. Indicates that people of Afghanistan are very much committed to their national interest and to the people's benefit. What we need is the international commitment to continue. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks very much.